If you personally know even two people who are blind, you know their visual impairments don't make them any more alike than any two people with 20/20 vision. But if you only know blind people as characters in books or Bible stories or movies and TV shows, you may have formed some misleading impressions about what they're like and what they're capable of, and those stereotypes have not done blind people any favors. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Storytellers have used blindness as a metaphor and a plot device for thousands of years, giving us a long tradition of tropes such as the helpless or pitiful blind character, the loss of sight as divine punishment or divine compensation for that loss, as in the blind person endowed with otherworldly wisdom or clairvoyance. M. Leona Godin is a writer, performer, and educator who is blind, and while she's interested in the ways these tropes have shaped perceptions of people with visual impairments, she thinks it's high time for blind people to have the freedom to tell their own stories. Her book is called Their Plant Eyes, A Personal and Cultural History of Blindness. Leona, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you so much, Chris. That was an awesome introduction.
Well, thank you. I really love the book, and it's given me so much to think about, including the fact you introduce a term here that's sort of at the heart of how our society understands blindness and blind people. Tell us about ocular centrism.
Yes, ocular centrism. I did not come up with it, but it's funny because it was something that was sort of buried deep in my mind from my graduate school days, from a book called Downcast Eyes by Martin Jay. And he's using it to kind of explain an anti-ocular centrism trend in kind of modern French theory. But I hadn't thought about this word, you know, since graduate school, and I was writing the book, and then I met up with some students. I was visiting a class, at Rice University, and they were reading this book, and they mentioned oculocentrism, and they were just sort of throwing it around with glee, and I thought, that's what I'm talking about throughout my entire book, and so I kind of reinvigorated the book with this term that really suggests that it's not just about not seeing, right? But that somehow not seeing is a less than state of being. It's believing that that position of not seeing, it does not provide you with the information that other people have, and so that then you are existing in a world that's kind of less than, as opposed to different than other people.
As a person who had typical vision for the first 10 years of your life or so, and then some vision for many years beyond, how do you think your life had been shaped by ocular centrism?
I think a lot of ways. One is that, especially as I was first losing my vision through my teens and 20s, the impulse, I think, on my part and by others, is to appear to be as sighted as possible. So that makes it really hard to do things like learn Braille and pick up the white cane. And so you're kind of congratulated a lot of times for, you know, people will say to you, oh, but you don't look blind, you know, and the impulse is to say, oh, well, thank you, you know, which is obviously extremely detrimental to self-worth, right? Because you're basically thanking someone for not looking like what you are. And then of course, on a practical level, it keeps you from developing the tools that you need to be the best blind person that you can be, as opposed to just kind of like, as a friend of mine says, as opposed to being sort of a broken sighted person. You know, we can be better blind people.
Sight and blindness metaphors have been used by storytellers and writers for thousands of years. Tell us about some of the most common tropes with regard to the meaning blind characters are meant to bring to these stories, because they're very rarely just people who happen to be blind. There's a reason for their blindness in these stories.
That's exactly right. Most of the time, the blind character is not the protagonist of the story, but they kind of enter the story in order to give some sort of life lesson. We can go back to, say, the days of ancient Greek tragedies, where you have Tiresias brought, you know, the blind seer brought on stage to deliver news that is pretty much always bad to the main character, something that they don't want to hear, which also kind of makes you wonder, why are they always there, right? The blind seer comes on and is usually kicked out by the king, saying, "That's not the prophecy I wanted to hear." And of course, famously in Oedipus, of course, Oedipus does become the blind character, but that's sort of his tragic end, at least in the Oedipus the King story. Of course, there is a sequel, but people don't really talk about the final play in that sequel, where Oedipus himself becomes sort of a blind prophetic figure in Oedipus at Colonus, which was actually turned into a gospel. But you're absolutely right that it tends to be that blindness means something, and I think that is usually, as you said in your introduction, on two very distant ends of the spectrum. On the one hand, you have the superpowers, which I'm going to also include sort of the prophetic and the poetic super blind, as well as our more modern superheroes on the one end. And then you have sort of the pitiable blind beggar or buffoon kind of on the other end of the spectrum. And there's not a lot of middle ground, which is where most blind people live, as mothers and people who work and go to school and go to work and take care of kids and all that sort of thing. So those are the experiences that kind of don't get revealed in these stories, where blindness always has a meaning, a metaphorical meaning beyond the lived experience, which is, as dynamic as anybody else's life experience.
When blind characters are there for us to admire, you know, stories even written in modern times often qualify as what is occasionally called inspiration porn, which is to say, it's remarkable that someone happens to be blind and lives a decent life.
Yeah, inspiration porn is something that, gosh, it's so pervasive that we almost don't recognize it sometimes. In terms of almost every news story that you're going to run into about a blind person, and I think this goes for disability in general, tends to need to have sort of this uplifting quality, this quality that the person has, this is the language, has overcome their disability in order to achieve something that is kind of marvelous because of that disability. And it's generally meant to make non-disabled people or people who do not just sort of define themselves as disabled to make them feel better about their own lives. And I think you're right to connect this with this idea of it being meaningful to the non-disabled perspective, as opposed to being simply meaningful in terms of, being a human being in the world who can offer something to the world because of our disability, not despite it.
You wrote a play years ago about Helen Keller, and we all think we know about her life because there was already a very famous play written about her, but that sort of ends really early in her life. What course did it take after that moment when she had her epiphany and learned how to communicate as a child?
Yes, she at the end of The Miracle Worker, she is, 7 years old, and there's the famous water pump scene where she learns, the meaning of language. But she lives to be 87 years old, and she had such a dynamic life. A lot of attention is starting to be brought to her politics that were very radical, very leftist. She was a card-carrying socialist. She was even somebody who promoted the idea of communism, but she also was very interested in workers' rights, in the rights of people of color. She was one of the first, I think, famous people to give money to the NAACP, fought for a woman's right to vote. All of these things were so important to her. I kind of focused in on my in my play. It was called The Star of Happiness, which was kind of taken from her theme song when she performed in vaudeville for 4 years, from 1920 to 1924. And this was an interesting time in her life because she was She was 40 years old when she went onto the vaudeville stage. And of course, people tried to say things like, oh, well, you know, you're being exploited, or she's being exploited. And she did it for extremely practical reasons. She was a very well-educated woman. Of course, she went to Radcliffe and she knew exactly what she was doing. So, kind of side note, that idea of exploitation, I think, really takes away from, you know, disabled people's agency and ability to kind of parse things out for themselves. But she did kind of run through her, you know, some books about her life. Everybody kept wanting her to write autobiographies. And then she did the lecture circuit for a number of years, and it was really grueling and stuff. So she finally got this opportunity to go into vaudeville and to make some decent money. And she very explicitly says in her book Midstream, you know, if I were to die, it would leave Annie Sullivan, who we often know as Teacher, it would leave her completely destitute because all the pensions that Keller was receiving would end with her death. And so she felt responsible for another person, which I think sometimes we don't realize that, right? We don't think, we always think about her being dependent on Annie Sullivan, but Annie Sullivan was also dependent on Helen Keller. So she, but you know, she ended up having a really great time in vaudeville. I mean, she met some of the great performers of that age, and she described it really wonderfully. But she also, I mean, there was a little bit of inspiration porn in it. I mean, you can imagine from a theme song like "The Star of Happiness." But and she did give some of her famous quotes. You know, like "Alone we can do so little, together we can do so much." But during the question and answer period, she was able to infuse her conversation with all kinds of very lefty remarks. Like my absolute favorite is, you know, this is 1920. They would ask her, "Well, what do you think of capitalism?" And she would say, "I think it has outlived its usefulness."
And people would accept this from her, do you think, because they weren't expecting her to be sort of politically subversive?
People did, you know what? I think the vaudeville audiences were very accepting. In other aspects of her life, not so much. She was heavily criticized. She wrote a series of essays called Out of the Dark, and that was in 1913, that was very much, you know, criticizing capitalist greed. People did not like this at all. It was definitely antithetical to their perception of what she is. And also, I think it speaks to the fact that a lot of times, blind and disabled people and deafblind people are expected to basically tell their own story over and over again. And if you dare to kind of speak out about issues that are beyond, you know, what people think of as your confined area of expertise, namely your disability, then you are criticized. And she was very much criticized for her opinions. But I think the vaudeville stage, it was like she could get away with a lot there because it was such a mixed audience. And it was sort of some of her really big, you know, statements were kind of framed in entertainment, as entertainment.
Leona, the legend goes that the Greek poet Homer was blind, but we know now that Homer himself may have been a kind of character, right? An amalgamation of numerous people who composed these epic poems attributed to a single individual. If Homer himself was not a living person, why would the story have persisted that he was blind?
Yes, that's a great question. I think there's a few reasons for that. Probably the most important is that the Homeric tradition, the Iliad and the Odyssey, comes from an oral tradition. So there would have been the possibility of blind bards, most definitely thriving in a world where literacy was completely by the ear and through music. So it makes a lot of sense. But once the epics were written down and sort of codified as these written objects, the likelihood that that person who wrote it down, or people who wrote down what we now know of as kind of these singular texts, as opposed to kind of the tapestry of texts that were probably sung beforehand, when it got written down and codified, it's pretty unlikely that that person was blind, because of course the literate literature of the day would have kept a blind person out of it, right? It would not have been possible, since it then becomes a visual medium as opposed to an oral one. I think another reason is, you know, Borges says that the Greeks kind of preserved this idea of Homer as being blind because poetry is at its base musical. It's a musical art. I think that that could be debatable, but I think that's another possibility. So I guess we like this idea of the blind poet. Another reason too is that we actually find a blind poet within the Odyssey, a character named Demodocus. And so we kind of get the feeling that this is a meta kind of a moment, right? Where we meet this blind bard in the Odyssey who can sing kind of any kind of song, from kind of body, sexy dancing songs to these great tragic songs that that makes Odysseus cry about the war. And then, of course, Odysseus, being the main character, finally asks for a very specific song, and that is a song of himself, one to glorify his own role in the ending of the Trojan War. And I like to say that, you know, that blind bard in the Odyssey kicks off or introduces then Odysseus's own tale, which is really the exciting tale, the one that we remember in the Odyssey, which is like the blinding of the Cyclops and the sirens and all of those kind of juicy tales that we remember.
All right, let's open a giant can of worms here that may take us the rest of the hour to unpack. How has Christian tradition used blindness as a metaphor?
Ooh, yes. So I love this can of worms. I think that there's a few things going on, but one is really fundamental in terms of the body and soul dualism. And in Christian tradition, and they really got this from especially sort of Plato and Socrates, the ancient Greeks, but the idea is that you need to get over your body in order to focus your attention on God, on the soul, on the eternal parts of yourself. And I think that eyes play a big part in, at least this is how the idea goes, in distracting you from the spiritual world. So you're led away, you're led to be a sinner, you know, by way of your eyes. And we see this playing out in countless, movies and plots, right? Somebody is kind of a bad dude, or they're not seeing things correctly. And so they are blinded in order to then kind of get their inner vision corrected. And that's part of it. And then also, again, back to this idea of blindness meaning something, of course, Jesus uses the healing of blind people as an example of God's power. And so that's part of it too. So I think you have two different kind of impacts on people today. And the one that I talk about in the book is how I have a friend that, is a choir leader and very much involved in the church, but she would have people say things to her like, "Oh, you can't sin because you're blind, so you don't have to worry about that." And she was like, "Well, you know, I struggle with sin just as much as anybody else, right?" And then the other one that is very detrimental, I don't talk about it as much, but, you know, the idea of blindness as punishment. So I've had friends tell me that people in the church will say things to them like, "Well, if you pray, then your blindness will go away. So you're not a good enough Christian." Right? So
wow.
There's the flip side of it. Yeah. Harsh.
Let's play one of probably the most famous hymns among Christians.
Amazing grace, oh how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost,
So, Leona, the blindness in that song is meant to be a metaphor, but I wonder if you think it still feeds a kind of demeaning belief that, again, that blindness is worse than sightedness for people who are blind.
Yes. I mean, I think that it's an interesting thing because, of course, a lot of people are going to say, well, it doesn't matter. This is blindness as a metaphor, right? So it doesn't affect us as blind people. But I think that it speaks to the metaphorical blindness, speaks to the fact that sightedness is just intimately linked with like consciousness, knowledge, understanding. And so in that song, of course, what we're talking about is the blindness of it's spiritual blindness, but I think that this also works in like, you know, countless rhetorical flourishes about, blind faith comes to mind, of course, but blind rage, blind drunk, even expressions like blind evolution, where yes, it's a metaphor, but what those metaphors mean is not being able to see, but not being able to understand.
We've arrived at this moment when I think a lot of us have learned to interrogate the effects of stigmatizing language and eliminate it from our vocabularies. Why do you think language around blindness has been like stubbornly resistant to that?
Oh boy. Well, I think because it is so powerful and that we just, dare I say, seen it so much in our literature, in our movies. And of course, you know, side note, I think you mentioned this at the top, but it bears repeating, you know, blind people have not been the creators of these stories for the most part. I mean, if we set aside Homer, you know, that's kind of it. You know, other than that, most of the stories that we get are told from the perspective of a sighted person. So I think that that's one really big sticking point. If we're not able to kind of wield the language in these powerful situations of blockbuster movies and novels and things like that, then it's really easy for these stereotypes to stick. And that goes across the board for disability, I believe. You know, representation matters. I think we've kind of figured that out in terms of race and LGBTQ situations, not situations, I'm sorry, LGBTQ perspectives, right? But for disability, we're still figuring this out. And so the language sticks because we're not writing the language. And then even people that I speak to, you know, that are from the deaf community, even they sort of admit, you know, blindness is, for whatever reason, probably because our world is pretty ocular centric, these blind metaphors just seem to be even more pervasive than with other disabilities, although disability is really all over our literature in so many ways. And I think that people are very resistant to changing their language. I'm not sure if this is where you were going, but I recently wrote an article for the New York Times about ableist language. And man, people are very resistant to wanting to shift their language. And at the same time, I think a lot of young people realize that this sort of needs to happen, right? That language shapes our thought. And when we use these terms unconsciously, they can have real negative effects. And, you know, when I'm sharing the adjective, you know, when I call myself a blind person, and in like 9 times out of 10, blind means something negative like thoughtlessness or unconsciousness, it's really hard for me to come up with any kind of blind pride, right? Because it doesn't really sound like a pride movement. Mm. It sounds like I can't see what a big ego I have or something, you know.
Deaf culture is so vibrant and precious to people who are part of it. Would you say there's anything parallel? Is there such a thing as blind culture?
Yes, I do believe so. Now, you're going to ask different blind people and they're going to have different responses. I do think that people that I have sort of gravitated to, other artists and writers, we are working really hard to show how blind culture and an embracing of blind culture is absolutely vital for any of us to kind of move forward in the world. And this speaks again to this idea of inspiration porn, because one of the many problems with inspiration porn is that you tend to hold up one singular individual above the rest. And what that does is dismantle community. And I think that the blind community has in some ways maybe given into that a little bit in the past. And there's a lot of us that are trying to shift that ideology and really push each other forward and help each other out in terms of realizing that there are things that connect us. You know, I think just of so many of my friends, blind artists, friend of mine who's a sound artist, Andy Slater, and you know what he's doing in terms of creating art that's not that is interested in sound is part of our blind cultural experience, and realizing that art for too long has been ocular centric, right? That art in a museum has tended to be things that you look at, and there's kind of a whole road that we could go down about that. But I think the most important thing about thinking about blind culture is that it supports blind community on the one hand, and it also makes it possible for us to shift mainstream in our direction a little bit and to actually create culture that is meaningful for us, that we can usher into and kind of usher them into it. Because I think too often we have this word inclusion, one-way street. You know, it's basically like, let us in, we're blind people, we want to experience the mainstream culture, but that is something that I think that a lot of us are trying to shift, you know, to say, wait a minute, our culture is important and mainstream is going to have to come our way a little bit.
I do want to talk here for a minute about the struggle some blind people have in the arts and in literature with just getting the chance to tell their own stories. Nobody seems to hesitate when a sighted screenwriter or a novelist wants to write a blind story. When a blind person wants to write a story, everybody assumes the only story you can possibly write is about a blind character.
Yeah, and even when we want to write about a blind character, but it's not the sort of the blind characters that we've seen in the past, it's still a struggle. So I tell a story in the chapter that's about blind writers, about a friend of mine who had, like, you know, 35 books under her belt. She writes romance stories, and just the struggles, first of all, for her to even get an agent to pay attention to her, and then an editor, and just flat out prejudice about taking her on. And then, you know, she ended up, you know, having quite a bit of success and stuff. And then she wanted to write a blind character that she felt was just a really real, raw blind character that would have to, well, I won't give you the plot because I think she's still trying to tell this story, but it's a good one. And she, you know, the editor basically said, well, I've never seen, you know, that's not true. Like, that's not a real blind story. Like, the editor felt so confident about what they have seen in the media that they were unapologetic about telling a blind person that she didn't know how to tell a blind story. So it's really pervasive, and it has everything to do with representation. And this goes across the arts. You know, I also tell a story about my friend Lori Rubin, who's an opera singer, and you know, opera, just like novels, loves, you know, the tragedy of blindness or what have you. But you'll basically never find an opera singer getting those big roles that is actually blind. I mean, she really struggled. I mean, even in her program, they wouldn't let her do the opera because they said, well, it's just too much trouble to have you on stage. You know, we don't need to take the time out to do that. So just unapologetic ableism that I think in this day and age, mostly, I mean, it is illegal, and yet it's unapologetic in certain situations, just because people just feel like, oh, there's no way that the blind person can do the same, not the same, but do a good job in the way that a non-blind person can.
I mean, is there a good way to sort of school people who make these mistakes, perhaps meaning well, but in ways that are really demeaning and embarrassing? I mean, what have you learned about coping with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this speaks to two things. One is that sighted people are so engaged with the faith, which is fine. That's absolutely wonderful. But the problem is that sighted directors, and I really think this comes to the movies. I really think that this is where this was all born, is that the idea that we would feel like we need to have interaction with the thing that the sighted person finds so informative, it speaks to oculocentrism, speaks to ableism. And again, I think that if we had, you know, scripts that were written by blind people, you're not going to have any face touching in there, right? Or even, you know, a blind person being consulted in a movie that's about blind people, that would be kind of eradicated. And you know, most of us will just laugh about it and say, you know, no, you know, I don't touch faces outside of the context that you would ordinarily touch faces. But it really speaks to the fact that so many blind people that I know, and this is certainly true for me, I get so much out of a voice. You know, I get so all those nuances that a very visual person is going to get from a face is something that I get from people's voices. And people are always sort of amazed, like, oh, how can you tell that I'm smiling? And you're on the radio, so you probably know this very well, right? I think that you can hear when somebody is smiling and you can hear when somebody's frowning, right? It's something that you're just simply more attuned to if you're not, you know, thinking about facial features at that moment or what the eyes are doing. I think sometimes we forget that all of us put a lot of pressure on not the thing itself, but what it means, you know, and it's not so much the face itself, but what it tells you in a non-linguistic manner or other kind of, it's a communication that's beneath or beyond words, right? And I think that that's also true for the human voice, and it's all just about what you're attuned to.
You're also an actor. Are you finding more directors wanting deliberately to cast someone who is blind to play someone who is blind?
It is huge. I mean, there have definitely been some shifts in the last 10 years. I would say that I am sort of an actor-ish. I mean, I have not trained as an actor. Mary Lee Talkington is one of the few blind actors out there. She was in the show C, and, you know, she actually graduated from an acting conservatory, but I tell her story in the book as well of the incredible prejudice, really right along the same lines as what Alice Eakes, the writer I was telling you about, experienced. So, you know, people, professors just dropping her from the class saying, I can't work with you. You know, if you can't read the script, if you can't read the script as it is, then you should not be an actor, you know, and now she's got this amazing career. And that's really been because things are beginning to shift.
M. Leona Godin is a writer, performer, and educator who is blind. Her book is called Their Plant Eyes, A Personal and Cultural History of Blindness. Leona, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for making time for us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Chris. Thanks a lot.
You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for KERA Think or catch up on the podcast and what you've missed at our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.